these kinds of tumors, we probably OC in our service. So in here they are talking about that the TTFN clone is using the more specific clones, which is the 8G7G3/1 clone. So using that clone for some poor differentiated non-small cell carcinoma, they describe a group of tumors that show diffuse P40 and diffuse TTF1 immunoreactivity. So this kind of tumor is kind of rare. And in this study, they collected 14 cases like that among three institutions, which is Memorial Sloan Kettering and Columbia Medical Center, and another one is from University of North Carolina. So in here, let me see. So total, there's 14 cases are collected, and 8 of the cases they also do NGS molecular study. 7 of the 8 cases, the molecular study were done in Memorial Sloan Kettering using their MSK Impact platform, which include more than 40 cancer genes. Whereas one case is contributed by the Columbia Medical Center, they use their simple NGS panel, which only include a few genes as listed in here. So let's see. So there's some basic information demonstrated in this table 2. You can see that of these 14 cases, the median age is 78 years old, and the gender is kind of equally distributed. Most of the patients have a smoking history, and the tumor size is around 2.9 cm. Most of the, about half of the cases presented with high stage 3 and 4, and most of the specimens are small biopsy specimens. And in here, they're showing the histology. So most of the tumors showing this very poorly differentiated morphology have some of the cases, or a lot of the cases, up to 40% of the cases showing this kind of like a basaloid morphology. And they show, again, very diffuse P40 and TTF1 co-expression, because this is the inclusion criteria. So all the cases are supposed to show more than 50% of P40 and TTF1 on the same population of tumor cells. And the other kind of morphology that can be seen in these 14 cases is this kind of like just non-small cell carcinoma morphology without definitive basaloid features. In here, I guess I will show the morphology first. A third morphology that they described is, again, very basaloid morphology, but there's focal, very definitive, like keratinizing for squamous differentiation. No obvious morphologic features of glandular differentiation is observed. However, if you do some immunomarkers, you can see some of the tumor cells also show focal staining for Nepcin A, and also mu C carmine is focally positive. So really showing this kind of like a dual differentiation. And back to this table, basically it's just showing some of the immunohistochemical markers. You can see in here, and also some with some histologic features, you can see the histology with the basaloid feature is kind of like a predominant feature in these 14 cases. Some locations showing focal keratinization, and a lot of cases showing necrosis. And most of the cases have like very diffuse P40 and TTF1 immunoreactivity. Many cases showing diffuse CK56 staining. Also significant cases showing focal Nepcin A and mucin carmine staining. Next. So they also analyzed 8 cases with NGS. Like I said, 7 cases were done using the MSK Impact platform, and one case only using a small panel with a few driver gene mutations, commonly known in lung cancer. And so you can see in these 14 cases, the most common gene alterations, including TP53 mutation and CDKN2A mutation, followed by KRAS and EGFR. So this KRAS mutation is a KRAS G12C mutation, and this EGFR mutation is the exon 20 insertion. So including three cases out of this nine cases being sequenced, they show this kind of like targetable gene mutation. They also found out that in terms of gene amplification, FGFR1 gene amplification seemed to be overrepresented in this group of tumor. So besides doing this NGS analysis on eight tumors of these 14 cases, they also compare these results with a large cohort of lung squamous cell carcinoma and lung adenocarcinoma. And you can see that in here, probably the most standing out genetic alteration is this FGFR gene amplification, which seemed to be much more overrepresented in this group of tumors that have this kind of like a biphenotypic differentiation. So clinical follow-up, this tumor, clinical follow-up is available in eight patients. Five showed metastatic disease, four patients died, three alive with disease, and one showed no evidence of disease after resection. Basically, I think this is, they summarized the five case report that reporting this kind of morphology, like poorly differentiated non-small cell carcinoma with both squamous and glandular differentiation. And in these five previous case report, they also show some EM findings, and the EM findings also demonstrate like this kind of dual differentiation in demonstrating intercellular lumina with microvilli, club cell granules, fascicles of keratin fibers, and desmosome. I think this is interesting tumor we probably have all seen in our pulmonary service, but this paper just a nice demonstration to describe the histologic features, the molecular features. And this group of tumors seem to perform poorly clinically because 50% of it have like a high stage at presentation, and many of them also presented with metastasis and die from disease. What else?
Were these screening detected or not?
I'm sorry?
Were these screening detected cancers or not? I only ask because if you had a cohort of patients with a median age of 78 who presented with symptoms of lung cancer, I would think any kind of histology would be associated with advanced stage on average. So I mean, it just didn't clear to me that they're any worse than anybody else with lung cancer if it's not a screening detected tumor. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, good point. Yes, I'm not sure. In this paper, they also said something about the histogenesis of this kind of like biphenotypic, poor differentiated non-small cell carcinoma. They think the histogenesis may be from the bronchial basal cells because the bronchiolar basal cell showing this expression of both TTF1 and P40. They also propose the name for this tumor. They propose using non-small cell lung cancer with biphenotypic differentiation as a terminology for this group of tumor. Lastly, I think in their discussion, they also mentioned think about this tumor when you see poor differentiated non-small cell carcinoma with basaloid features and diffuse TTF1 and P40 co-expression. But they say sometimes seeing this kind of like TTF1, P40 co-expression in poorly differentiated lung cancer, it could be this tumor, but they also mentioned a tumor which is a DAC AFF2 rearranged lung cancer. And this is a lung cancer that actually initially has been described in the head and neck region, but the Dr. Reitman also described a case report of this tumor also occurred in the lung. Basically, it's looking like also very basaloid, has this kind of papillary architecture, look like inverted papilloma, very kind of like uniform basaloid morphology, and this tumor diffusely stained like with squamous markers, and also TTF1, both P40 and TTF1 are diffusely positive, but this tumor is having this specific translocation, which is a DAC AFF2 rearrangement. So I just want to mention, even when you have this diffuse expression, also think about whether it could be this rare, rearranged, poor differentiated lung cancer. I think that's about it for this article. Any other questions?
So is it now how we should sign them out? Non-small cell carcinoma with biphenic differentiation?
That's and highly recommended.
Is the message that they all should under, I mean, if they are not resectable, that they should actually get molecular testing?
I think so, because some of they tested 8 cases and 3 cases showing a typical lung cancer driver mutation, like the KRAS G12C and the typical EGFR mutation. So I think that's one of the message. When you have this kind of cancer, always do some molecular testing, because a certain proportion of it will show the typical lung cancer driver mutation that is targetable.
Thank you.
As I understand it, that's more or less the current recommendation from the NCCN for all non-small cell lung cancers, right? If they're advanced stage, so.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, if no further questions, I will move on to the second paper. Second paper, also from histopathology. So the 4 papers I am going to present today, 3 of them are from histopathology. So the second paper from histopathology is about lung carcinoid tumors. Again, it's investigating about the role of Ki-67. This has been a long debated topic. But I just think we need more these kind of studies, because clearly the current WHO is now not ideal in separating these tumors and also causing some confusion. So just a quick overview. This is because in this paper they're talking about the GI system, because right now the diagnostic criteria for neuroendocrine tumor, basically we have two big camps. One is the GI pancreas criteria, the other one is the lung or thoracic criteria, and they are slightly different. So in here, just a quick overview of the GI system. So in the GI system, they propose that there are 2 distinct categories: the well-differentiated neuroendocrine tumor and the poorly differentiated neuroendocrine carcinoma. And within the well-differentiated neuroendocrine tumor, they separate into 3 grades, grades 1, 2, 3. And in here, the Ki play a very significant role in terms of further grading of the well-differentiated neuroendocrine tumor. And also in the GI system, GI pancreas system, there's an extensive molecular study has been performed and demonstrating that the neuroendocrine tumor has very distinct molecular alteration from the neuroendocrine carcinoma. And usually neuroendocrine tumor does not further progress into a neuroendocrine carcinoma. So I think in the lung or thoracic neuroendocrine classification system, we don't have the Ki-67 playing a role in the classification. And also in the pulmonary neuroendocrine tumor or neuroendocrine neoplasm, we don't have a category of grade 3 neuroendocrine tumor, which I think it does exist. And because this kind of a high-grade neuroendocrine tumor does exist, also causing some confusions. Current WHO still, I think the current WHO still have the same diagnostic criteria as the previous WHO in 2015. The diagnostic criteria for neuroendocrine tumor in the thoracic cavity remains the same, meaning Ki does not play a role. And the reason that WHO is giving is because there's no consistent threshold has been found for Ki-67 proliferation index to separate typical carcinoid tumor from a typical carcinoid tumor. And in the article that we are going to describe, they give some data regarding the threshold that they propose to separate typical from atypical carcinoid tumors. And there are some conflicting data regarding the role of Ki-67 in further separating carcinoid tumor in the lung. Again, cutoff point for Ki-67 seem to be difficult. So the current WHO is looking for more data before they implement a Ki-67 as a diagnostic tool for pulmonary neuroendocrine tumor or thymic neuroendocrine tumor. And also, like I said, in the current WHO, they recognize that neuroendocrine tumor with high proliferation index exists, but they still want us to put it into the large cell neuroendocrine carcinoma category. So to me, this is very confusing to the clinician, because biologically it's supposed to behave like a carcinoid tumor. However, based on the thoracic neuroendocrine neoplasm classification, we ought to put it under large cell neuroendocrine carcinoma. So to me, for the oncologist, that is very confusing. Anyhow, this is a problem in this field, and this article is trying to add some data to address some of these problems. So in here, this is from Italian group. So in here, there's a lot of very complex statistics analysis. I probably cannot explain it too well, but maybe you guys can help me along the way. So in this one, basically, they have in their cohort, they have 200, in total, let's see, maybe here is a better diagram. So, okay, so in here, in there, they identify 370 lung carcinoid tumors from their database. And in the end, they included 350 confirmed carcinoid tumors, including 297 typical carcinoid tumors and 58 atypical carcinoid tumor. And then among this, they did the Ki-67 in 317 of this cohort. And also this report not only analyzing the Ki-67 labeling index, they also did some immunomarkers. Among one of the immunomarkers that they emphasized quite a bit in this article is this Osteopedia wholemeal box or OTP, and because these markers in the previous studies seem to show that loss expression correlated with worse prognosis. So in this study, they also did some investigation of this marker along with other immunomarkers. So in this cohort, let's see, go to their, So using the ROC curve, they identified 3% as the best cutoff value for Ki-67 to predict disease-free survival. And this 3% seem to correlate with the GI criteria in separating grade 1 from grade 2 well-differentiated neuroendocrine tumor. So this is the ROC curve to demonstrate that 3% seem to be the best cutoff value to have the best sensitivity and specificity. Then
were these manually counted? How did they get their Ki-67 index? I can't tell from their methods.
They didn't really mention it, but they said they counted like using the hotspots. I don't know.
Right.
I think probably it's manually. They didn't talk about using any like automatic way to do it.
It feels if you're proposing Ki-67, you ought to tell people how you did it.
Yeah, there's not much details. They just say they counted based on the GI criteria using the strongest nuclear labeling at the hotspot, as indicated in the WHO 2019 digestive system tumors. They counted 500 to 2,000 tumor cells in the hotspots. Yeah, no details about it. Okay, so they established, first they established 3% as a good cutoff, and using this 3% cutoff, they see that a good correlation using this 3% cutoff in separating typical from a typical carcinoid tumor also correlated with a higher stage of the tumor. Also show good correlation with mitosis, necrosis, and also seem to have a good correlation in predicting a survival. Next table is about all these immunomarkers. I think they emphasize quite a bit on this OTP, and the Ki-67 seem to have as 3% cutoff seems to have a good correlation with the loss of OTP expression. So the P53 they also used in here, but I don't know how to interpret the data because it just, because usually I think P53, the immunostain, we want to predict the underlying TP53 mutation, but with this kind of data, I don't know how to interpret their result. And in here, they're just showing some graph to show the Ki-67 at 3% cutoff. If they are looking at the cancer-specific survival, they can see that this cutoff can have a statistic significance in terms of, this comes out, have statistics significance in separating patients in terms of cancer specific survival. And same thing, the histology, like typical versus atypical carcinoid tumor, also seem to be pretty good in this risk stratification. And in here, they show OTP expression, the absence of it also correlated with worse survival, which is a statistically significant. And in here, they're showing SSTR2A, absence of expression of this marker, also showing statistic significance correlation with survival. So there's a lot of statistics associated with this paper. And in this table three, they show the univariate analysis of like overall survival, cancer-specific survival, or disease-free survival of patients with lung carcinoid tumor. And you can see that among all three kinds of survivals, and the histology type, the N stage, the higher N stage, higher T stage or clinical stage, and the higher mitosis, presence of necrosis, and the Ki-67 and 3% cutoff all seem to have a good correlation with survival based on this univariate analysis. And also in this same statistic model, OTP expression also seem to correlate with survival, like absence of its expression correlates with worse survival. Next. This is a same kind of graph. Instead of the previous similar graph, it's talking about cancer-specific survival. And in here, this is talking about disease-free survival. And in with different parameters, like again, in disease-free survival, the Ki-67 at 3% cutoff seem to be a good cutoff in correlating with survival. And again, histology type also showing good statistics significance in correlating with survival. So it's N stage and OTP expression status. And this is a table four showing the multi-variable models in analyzing overall survival, cancer-specific survival, and disease-free survival. So in here, they have two models. So in each model, they drop off because their interest is about Ki-67 at 3% cutoff. So in model two, they drop off the Ki-67 from the model. And in model one, they take out the histology type and do a comparison. So in basically about the same, in no matter it's model one or model two, you can see that the histology type is a good factor in correlating with survival. So it's true for the Ki-67 at cutoff of 3%, which is true among all these different kinds of survival. And this one, again, this is also, again, different models trying to see the role of Ki-67 and histologic type, whether to see them individually and put them together to see whether putting them together, adding more prognostic information by modeling like this way. So in here, you can see that in this model, I mean, overall survival in this model, they include center, period of diagnosis, age, stage, OTP expression, Ki-67, and histologic type. And you can see in here, the histologic type does not seem to add more value in terms of prognosis. However, in this model, I just feel like doesn't seem like a unique Ki-67 or histologic type. It's already pretty good in predicting survival. So I don't know about this. Next. So it's a similar conclusion for overall survival and cancer specific survival, meaning adding histology to Ki or adding Ki to histology type does not seem to have any additional prognostic value. However, in the next model, in the disease free survival model, they identified that adding Ki-67 to histology seem to have additional prognostic value, as shown in here, but not a lot. So some of the statistics is kind of confusing to me, but I think the message is that the Ki-67 cutoff at 3% seem to be a good cutoff in better separating carcinoid tumor. And this cutoff seem to have a good correlation with prognosis. But this cutoff is proposed by this paper. I mean, in their discussion, they also mentioned a cutoff by other papers. Like in this paper, they mentioned about 3.5% cutoff. And in here, they also mentioned a 5% cutoff. And this paper they referred is actually Dr. Favre's paper that we also reviewed a couple of years ago. That's a paper from Dr. Favre in 2019. In this paper, she proposed a 5% cutoff. And also in Dr. Favre's paper, she also said that the only significant predictor of carcinoid tumor recurrence on multivariate analysis is the Ki-67 index. So clearly, I think Ki probably will be an important a prognostic factor, probably should be incorporated into the next edition of the WHO for neuroendocrine neoplasm. What else? And also in this paper, they briefly mentioned that within their cohort, they also see three carcinoid tumor has very high Ki-67 labeling index, which is more than 20%, and which is equivalent to the GI system proposed grade 3 well-differentiated neuroendocrine tumor. And these three patients seem to have a bad prognosis, but very few cases. So I think that's pretty much the message for this paper. Kind of interesting to know whether you guys do any Ki-67 for your pulmonary or thymic neuroendocrine tumor. If you do, how you count your Ki? I just had a reason. Yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
Oh, I was going to say, yeah, we always do Ki-67 because our oncologists want it anyway. And we do the hotspot, and we do, I think, based on 2,000 cells, like they normally do. We do it manually, yeah. But our oncologists demand it, and they want to know what it is.
I think that probably something is coming, and I think probably neuroendocrine tumor should be regarded as one organ system instead of in different anatomic location. We give different sets of rules for this type of tumor. Like recently I had the tumor board like with a thymic neuroendocrine neoplasm showing high proliferation index. to a point that you have to put into the large cell neuroendocrine carcinoma, higher morphologically, just look like a typical carcinoid tumor. Mm-hmm. And why I present kids in the tumor board, it's just very confusing to the oncologist because they don't know how to treat the patient. Even though I keep saying biologically, this would be different from the conventional large cell neuroendocrine carcinoma, but some of the oncologists saying, but on your legal document, you're calling large cell neuroendocrine carcinoma, right? So we are going to treat so. So I think there's still some problem. I think Ki-67 probably can help to address some of the problem in better risk stratifying these neuroendocrine tumors or neoplasms. Any other questions?
I presume the treatment is different between large cell neuroendocrine and atypical carcinoid. The treatments would be different?
Yeah, I think so.
They look, I mean, they look so different. Small cell and large cell to me are different animals compared to carcinoid. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so if no more questions, we will move on to the third article. So third article is about using NF2 hemizygous loss detected by FISH in diagnosing pleural mesothelioma in tissue and cytology material. So this one, I don't think the information is entirely new. This is from a Japanese group. So as you all know, that NF2 genetic alteration is specific for malignant mesothelioma. It's specific in malignant mesothelial proliferation. And this has been observed in up to 68% of pleural mesothelioma based on the NGS gene analysis from a paper done by Dr. David Chipple, who is also currently a faculty member in here. And also I think we reviewed this paper in our journal class, journal club too. So in this particular study, they are just trying to understand the diagnostic utility of NF2 FISH by detecting NF2 hemizygous loss for diagnosing malignant pleural mesothelial proliferation. And they also are trying to see what's the combined sensitivity with the well-known ancillary studies to diagnose mesotheliomas, including BIP1 by HC and CDKN2A homozygous deletion by FISH. So in here, basically they pull the cases from six Japanese hospitals, and which include 106 surgical and 107 cytology specimens. And they also have native control groups, which including 37 surgical and 31 cytology specimens with benign mesothelial proliferation. So briefly, you can see in here, among the surgical specimen, hemizygous loss of NF2 has been detected in about 55% of the mesotheliomas. And within this hemizygous loss, 54 is monosomy of this chromosome 22, whereas four cases demonstrated heterozygous deletion of NF2. Similar data are seen in the cytology specimen too, also with sensitivity around 50%. And a majority of the hemizygous loss is due to monosomy. And also you can see most of the abnormality observed mainly in abyssinoid, more commonly seen in abyssinoid mesothelioma than biphasic or sarcomatoid mesotheliomas. So I will show some of the data from the paper. Oh, this is just some histology and the FISH results and BIP1 loss as an example they shown in this paper. So in here, they also trying to understand whether this ancillary studies have any correlation with the histologic grading for abyssinoid mesothelioma. And the answer is no, they don't see any correlation of this ancillary study with the grading. And here, I think it's kind of interesting to show that, so commonly, I think it's quite robust already by using the dual markers, including BEP1, IC, and CDKN2A FISH. The sensitivity is already up to 94% for tissue and 88% for cytology specimen. And in this particular cohort, and they analyze if you add NF2 FISH to detect the hemizygous loss, you can see the sensitivity can be increased a bit, I mean, close to 100, but some improvement. And I also think they showed us interesting diagram in here. So in their tissue cases, they have 106 cases of malignant mesothelioma. And in here, they analyzed, so among the 106 malignant mesotheliomas, 104 of them showing one or all of these genetic alterations. Only two cases, as shown in here, demonstrated no genetic alteration can be detected by either BEP1 loss or NF2 hemizygous loss or CDKN2A homozygous deletion. So among these 104 cases with one or two or three genetic alterations, you can see 25 of them have like all three alterations, which is about 24% of all these cases. And among these 25 cases, 76% were 19 cases epitheloid mesothelioma, and 6 cases were 24% of the cases are biphasic mesotheliomas. None of these 25 cases sarcomatoid mesothelioma. And then you can see by adding more tests, you can see more positivity because some mesothelioma just have a single genetic alteration among these three most common genetic alterations for malignant mesothelioma. And in here, they're trying to see whether this were correlated with survival. But just as we know already, that the histologic typing and the grading of epitheloid mesothelioma and the CDKN2A homozygous deletion have prognostic significance, whereas this ancillary study doesn't seem to have a good correlation with survival. Whereas BEP1 loss by HC or hemizygous loss of NF2 by FISH doesn't seem to show a correlation with survival. So I think basically these tests are just trying to sell the NF2 loss by FISH as a good diagnostic test to increase the sensitivity of detecting meso, where the specificity still remain as 100%. I also want to draw your attention to this month's letter to editor by Dr. Chirk. Also I put in our summary. So in here, Dr. Chirk is analyzing whether Merlin as an antibody to correlate with NF2 genetic alteration as a good marker for detecting mesothelioma. So in this one, basically Dr. Chirk trying to verify the result that has been demonstrated by David a couple, like maybe last year, in this really comprehensive study in demonstrating that Merlin could be a good ancillary marker to detect underlying NF2 genetic alterations. But just so you know, in this study, the NF2 like sensitivity is around, I guess 60% something. Basically, it's not all mesothelioma with underlying NF2 alteration can be detected by Merlin antibody. But it's good amount of it can be detected by the Merlin antibody. So in here, Dr. Chir just confirmed, yeah, this is probably a good test, but we need more data to support it. Merlin antibody, and in here, Dr. Chir test two different clones. One clone was used by David, the other clone is a new clone detecting different portion of Merlin. And he liked the second clone better because it just showing better signals than the clone that David used in his paper. But this is also seemed probably is going to be a good marker in adding more value or increase the sensitivity to detecting malignant mesothelioma. So that's about it for this paper. Any questions?
Yeah, I just wanted to make a comment. Thank you for going over such a complex area. I was just looking at the abstract, and they talk about BAP1 and CDKN2A loss were observed in a pretty high percentage of epithelioid mesotheliomas. But in is that a typo? 9% of sarcomatoid for BAP1 and 91% for CDKN2A. And only 27% for NF2HL. So it doesn't look like it's that useful for sarcomatoid. So those figures seem to be a bit different to what I've seen in previous.
So BAP1 is, you don't see much BAP1 loss in sarcomatoid mesial, but you see a lot of CDKN2A homozygous deletion in sarcomatoid mesial.
Is it that high normally in sarcomatoid? Have other papers published that 91% in sarcomatoid?
I think it's about in that bulk. It's like different papers have different percentage. I think it's pretty high. Some papers is talking about CDKN2A loss in sarcomatoid mesial, even up to 100%.
70%. Yeah. I guess every cohort will have different, slightly different percentages, but it shows that BAP1 is more useful for epithelioid and.
Yeah, exactly. BAP1 is more useful for epithelioid mesial. And in this paper, they're also arguing that LF2 hemizygous loss is more seen in epithelioid than sarcomatoid mesial.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. So I only have a few minutes, but I think the last paper is really kind of like easy paper. So this paper also from histopathology is about analysis of mucin core protein expression profiles from bronchiolar adenoma. So in this one, basically they collected 10 proximal type and 10 distal type of bronchiolar adenoma, and they trying to understand the mucin core protein profiles in bronchiolar adenoma. And I made a table in here, basically showing that bronchiolar adenoma showing kind of like similar mucin protein profiles as the normal bronchioles. So which probably you can conclude that bronchiolar adenoma is coming from the bronchial epithelium based on this mucin profiles. So in this paper, I thought it's kind of interesting to show that diagnosing bronchiolar adenoma is difficult on frozen. So among these 20 cases, 18 cases had underwent frozen section diagnosis, and only 7 cases, or 39% of the cases, were accurately diagnosed as bronchiolar adenoma at the time of frozen. And there are a total 9 cases that had a misdiagnosis on frozen sections as either an adenocarcinoma in situ or invasive mucinous adenocarcinoma. So I think this is a known phenomenon, and probably the pulmonary pathologist won't make that mistake, but the non-pulmonary trained pathologists, when they see so much busy proliferation, will probably fall into the trap in calling something bad and trigger more extensive surgeries. And this paper also did some molecular studies, and basically the molecular studies is similar to previous that we already know that for bronchiolar adenoma is showing this kind of like mutually exclusive gene mutations, including BRAF. BRAF V600E mutation is the most common ones, followed by KRAS mutation and EGFR mutations. And the EGFR mutations seen in here is not the kind of like driver mutations you often see in lung cancer. This kind of EGFR mutation is the kind of mutation that you often see in nasal sinus inverted papilloma. They also saying that the glandular papilloma and mixed squamous cell and glandular papilloma probably are different, even though histologically look similar to bronchiolar adenoma, genetically might be different from it, because in their study, they also did not detect any AKT1 mutation, but this AKT1 mutation has been detected in all the glandular papilloma or mixed papillomas. Yeah, I think that's a simple paper. We probably won't use that information. We probably won't do the MAC protein staining for a diagnosis of bronchiolar adenoma. But I run out of options, so I choose this paper. Any questions?
Has anyone ever seen these at frozen section?
I recently in here I see a misdiagnosis of this one by a non-pulmonary pathologist. I think this is really hard on frozen.
Yeah.
Has everyone abandoned the old term and replaced it with bronchiolar adenoma, the ciliated mucronodular papillary tumor?
They usually put both in a comment, depending on the morphology.
Isn't they still interchangeable? I mean, kind of like WHO put both terms in there.
You know, if I see mucin and cilia, you know, I'll use like the distal versus proximal type for bronchiolar adenoma, and then in a comment say, you know, this is equivalent to ciliated mucronodular papillary tumor. If I don't see it though, I'll say it's more like a distal type BA.
I have to learn how to recognize those someday.
Okay. If not, I think 10 o'clock, I conclude my journal club.
Thank you, Tao.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you.